I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Fall is finally here, so it's time to get funky and devote an episode to some of our favorite spunky microbes.
Fungi just provide this beautiful, whimsical lens on how the world works. They have so many roles. They're this strange and magical-seeming group of organisms, but they've got it all figured out.
Should you eat the cheese rind? Can you eat the rind? These are like the biggest questions.
We'll answer all of your questions about mysterious mushrooms and crazy curds. Plus, we'll give you a sneak listen to the newest season of Modernist Breadcrumbs. So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
Women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new rocket.
All right, thank you, Ike Turner. Thank you, Rocket 88, the first rock and roll song ever created. Because he messed with the synthesizer. He altered the sound of the guitar. So it's ironic that we play that song, isn't it, Emily?
Very.
Because this was the first radio show on the Heritage Radio Network. A media source that takes food as a serious issue, not as a fashion, not as a trend. Food is serious. It encompasses all of the disciplines, agronomy, environmentalism, biology, chemistry, anthropology, sociology. It's all under the umbrella of gastronomy and food. So we need a real station, first rock song, first food show here. So very excited. I love that they did that Meat and Three on microorganisms this week. Because Carlo Pacini, founder of Slow Food, said, we will form an international defense for microorganisms because if you pasteurize everything, we will become sick. And it was really a great line when he first started Slow Food. So it's exciting they're doing that. We got a skeleton crew. It's just me and Emily in studio.
Good morning. Don't forget, this is the main course OG. Patrick has yet to announce that part.
Yes. Bad radio for 10 years with host Patrick Martins. So I like to get a C. That's what I'm always striving for. But we have very few people in studio today, but very good people. So we have Evan Hanscore of Egg. And say hi, so we know your voice.
Hello.
And Action Jackson Stamper of Employees Only. Welcome.
How you doing?
All right. So
have you two ever met each other before?
We have not. Just now.
Because, you guys late. Seem not to like each other.
That's why we showed up early, so we could.
They showed up early. Yeah. They sat on opposite sides of the studio.
It's very tense between them, and we figured that there was bad blood or history. Well, that's nice to know.
All right. Well,
I think it's just something about this studio that,
it's just bad energy. Aggressive.
Yeah. Bad energy. Yeah. All right. We got to light some incense, do a little voodoo or something.
That's why we keep coming back.
Yeah. All right. Well, welcome to the show, guys. We're really excited to have you on. We're going to jump right into the weekly base. We do a roundtable format and talk about news of the week. We got a little promo music. So we're going to start a little serious. An estimated 97% of the U.S.'s 73 million hogs are raised in closed barns or confined feeding operations. In these systems, sows often live the majority of their lives in gestation or farrowing crates that don't allow them to get up or turn around. In the system, the average sow produces 23.5 piglets per year, or 10 per litter at a rate of 2.35 litters annually. But after 2 to 4 litters, most sows tend to be replaced by younger gilts who can produce piglets at a higher rate, which means they're done. Their life is over. This is not how the heritage system works. This is the commodity system.
Thank you for confirming that.
Yeah, I hope everybody knows. This was a piece that ran a partnership of Civil Eats and The Guardian this week. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, who wants to start?
I mean, it's just depressing, really.
Yeah, talk close to the mic, don't forget. But it's totally depressing, right?
Yeah, it's just, it's horrible to see. It's a hard thing. I think America has a lot of problems with its relationships to food and where it comes from. And I think that's just a great example of it.
For me, it's like 97%. Yeah. Just that number. I didn't even need to read the rest. The fact that 97% come out of this system.
Yeah, it's an uphill battle, right? For like what the work Heritage is doing and chefs are trying to do. And I wonder like what percentage people would think are raised that way, because so much of like marketing around food and especially like animals these days is about the idyllic pastured whatever sort of scene. Yeah. And I'm sure people have a perception that like, yeah, maybe 50 or 30 or something mm-hmm. percent are raised the bad way, but things are good. You know, things are getting better.
Well, it goes to show how small the farmer's market of America mm-hmm. are. It's mm-hmm. still a very minuscule, because I think all those pigs are being raised the correct way. So right. even with 26 green markets in New York and in San Francisco, right. the Ferry Plaza in Madison is famous for there. Even in Las Vegas, our friend Zach Allen helped start a farmer's market, a wholesale farmer's market for chefs. So it's still just a drop in the bucket. But, you know, we mustn't forget, I mean, this just talks about sows, you know, but really it's all the pigs that suffer. So, I mean, just to confirm what scumbags, you know, run the meat industry, you know, first of all, animals cannot speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we forget that. So you're like, no, my dog likes being alone for 9 hours. I'm like, because he can't tell you what a dick you are. You know, that's why yeah. they can't speak. So when something can't speak, you really do have to spend extra time thinking about them. And then the other crime, and this is why Heritage started, was the genetics, right? Because it's actually they're bred to grow that much. You're not supposed to do 2.35 litters annually. You're not supposed to grow in a third the time that a pig in nature grows.
Yeah.
That's what's messed up. These animals are sick.
Have you guys seen Okja, the movie on Netflix? I just watched it this week.
You just told me you don't watch movies.
I know. I don't. This is why it's an anomaly, and I don't know how it lined up so perfectly with our agenda today. It's this gorgeous film. I think it's made by like a Chinese sort of surrealist filmmaker, but it's a very sort of American style feature film in a way, but it's really beautiful, so upsetting. And it's basically kind of a story about this, told with enough sort of fantasy and distance to make it really hit home and not make people get defensive about it. It's not
how
like
do they make fantasy out of something like this? I mean,
it's about these super pigs and they're raised at different, you know, they send them out to different rural farmers around the globe and they bring them back for this big competition. But, and it's all about sort of the marketing behind this. And ultimately, it's, you know, revealed that it's
like
part of a huge factory farm. Yeah.
So it's a movie that's kind of, I think, highlights the way that they try to give a good image to something terrible that they're doing.
Mm. Yeah, you should watch.
But is the takeaway that we shouldn't be doing it that way?
Yeah. Okay. It's very clear that like this is fucked up, but it's told in like a pretty like personal way.
Well, any movie with pigs. I mean, Babe is a great pig movie. And then there are also all these famous pigs. Porky Pig. Who are the famous pigs?
Miss Piggy,
yeah.
Let's bring the female favorites into the room. No, I think, well, now I have to see that movie for sure. Yeah. So thank you for the suggestion. But I don't know.
It's terrible. We allow terrible things to happen. I mean, I always talk about fiscal Republicans. These are the good guys. These are the good Republicans who allow so much shit. They tolerate so much shit in their party on their watch just for the fiscal. And we can't be that way. By the way, I had a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich this morning, and God knows where that freaking bacon came from. It was probably disgusting.
I loved it.
But isn't that it? Isn't that like making the decision, like when you go to a taco truck, to not get the delicious carnitas because of this, right?
A slow turning of the wheel. It's not, you know, we're not Luddites. We're not like crazy. I don't ever, not at all.
And it's driving a battleship. It takes a while to make the whole thing.
It's a slow turn. It'll always be. But as you say, 97%, that's a shit show. So.
All right. I'm changing subjects. Let's talk Japan.
Thank you.
Evan, you just got back. Well, you visit often. I think you also just got back. We were curious. Why are the Japanese so fascinated with American breakfast? Egg has a location there. Our friends at Clinton Street Baking Company. I know Sarah Beth's has a location. I'm sure there's several others from the U.S.
Yeah, let's talk Japan.
There's a bunch of American businesses there, but particularly food businesses. I mean, it seems like there's a fascination with American culture in general. Like, they love Western sort of Americana vibe, really into a lot of the street fashion and music scenes from over here as well. But I don't know if it's been this way for a while or it's recent, but there's definitely an interest in American food. And I'm not sure why. I mean, there's an interest in egg because we have a bunch of Japanese tourists who end up here in Brooklyn. So it sort of makes
sense. But end up here in Brooklyn, and is it driven by social media?
Or the style of your restaurant?
I think they might end up here in Brooklyn because we were in a guide or something, or people on, you know, Instagram or friends at this point have recommended it. But it's, you know, it's a totally, the food exists in a totally different context there than it does here, of course. You know, here it's comfort, nostalgia, familiar, and there it's new and, you know, exotic in the way like a new restaurant from a different country is to us here. So that's been really interesting to not be like comfort food breakfast, but to be a different sort of thing in that culture and I don't know, lineup.
Well, I love Japan. It's so tiny. They can't go confinement agriculture because there's no room to do it. Everything is so pristine and pure there. I mean, every chef I ask, what's your favorite cuisine? I just like saying, is it France? I would say 70% of them say Japanese cuisine, what they do, the way they serve food and all that. Mm. I mean, are you fascinated by Japan?
I'm hugely fascinated by Japan. And I think I do have a little insight as to why they have such an obsession with American culture. I think it goes back to... they were one of the last countries to really allow foreigners into their country. Mm-hmm. And it was the late 1800s, I think, when they finally started to push to industrialize. And then they still remained fairly closed off. And then the war happened, World War II. And we won, and so we occupied them. So we were the first real culture that their citizenship got a look at. And I think ever since then, they've kind of emulated. And
we showed them the way of, like, the scrambled egg or the over easy. I don't know.
Over easy.
I mean, I think they just started to it was so different for them, you know. It was generations of no contact with other cultures. Yeah. And then suddenly they're seeing a vastly different way of living because we just couldn't be more opposite.
Yeah.
And so they just see it and it's different. It's like when you're growing up and you want to do what's different from your parents, or you want to do what's, so it's when you see something different, you just want to explore it and check it out. And I think that has kind of pulled through all these years with them for decades. So,
well, I'm a big fan of like the $20 bite, you know, a $20 piece of sushi. Mm-hmm. I think it's absolutely worth it, you know, just to get a raw thing that's dealt with perfectly.
Yeah. Cheap sushi scares me.
Oh, yeah.
Like I will say there's a ton of amazing cheap sushi over there.
Over there, it wouldn't scare me. But cheap sushi here in America, always, I'm just like, why
would
you
want to get the cheap? Well, they don't have to fly it anywhere. Right, just exactly. Right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Emily, I'll tell you, when she takes a cruise, it's the raw fish at the buffet that she will never get near. She won't even touch a spoon that's
I ran
there.
Into Evan, right? I think right after I got off the cruise, and we were talking about the one you were going on, and I was like, the buffet is great. If it's a high-end cruise, the buffet is great. I'm like, but octopus, I don't know.
Right.
That sort of cold station. If you know you stopped in port to replenish, okay. Otherwise, I'm out.
Yeah.
But Japan's crazy. Their Akiyushi beef is like one of the best beef, the most marbled beef. Then they get anchovies from Sicily. So Sicilians actually ship their anchovies to Japan because the Japanese demand the very best. Yeah. I love that idea. Slow food, by the way, was never about eating locally unless gastronomically it tasted better. Mm. Carlo was shipping food from all over the world. If he could get a truffle from Siberia because it tasted better, if it even existed, he would. Because that's
how so interesting because for me, like, the mental association with the snail is also that he wasn't traveling very far. He was just coming local.
Right. It just took him forever to get there.
Got it. I don't
but
know.
Everyone gets ghost ends up in the same place anyway, so you might as well get there slowly. That was his line. You know, everyone's going to die. So, but anyway, Japan is absolutely fascinating. And my favorite Japanese restaurant, even though they stopped buying from us, so I hate them, but is Morimoto. Because sometimes Japanese restaurants can be a little dire. We talk with our friend Cesare. He's like, I don't want to sit at a bar silent while some guy like has three little pieces. But Morimoto is fun and loud.
I will sit there silently if they do that thing where they like place it in your mouth.
In your mouth?
For the whole... I want the full experience.
So you won't talk while a chef is sticking something in your mouth, you're like, I still have the floor. Hold on.
Pause, please. Let's hold this conversation. Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. Well, I speaking of breakfast, so you're a breakfast place, which I find fascinating because you're viewed like we view Union Square Cafe. We think of you in the same way, but you're closed for dinner. No, but I mean, we don't think of you different, you know, just like we don't think of Clinton Street. These are restaurants, but So Evan, why not keep Egg open for dinner? And Jackson, why not have employees only open for breakfast and lunch? Why not do that? So yeah, why
you want
are
me to take the lead?
Yeah.
I mean, me personally, I've worked a lot of places before doing breakfast and lunch, and I personally just hate getting up that early. Uh-huh. But
what time would you have to get up to open for lunch, for instance, if you were opening chef?
For lunch, I mean, you'd probably want the doors open by 11 a.m.
So what time would you have to get there?
I'd have to get there probably at like 9:30.
So an hour and a half to prep everything?
Just to make sure everything's in place, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to be there. As the person in charge, you got to be there pretty early to make sure if someone doesn't show up, you can cover it and handle it. But that's just my personal belief, but I also have I also feel strongly that places kind of create their own individual identity, and sometimes it works in places and sometimes it doesn't. We actually tried a while back to do brunch at employees only, and it's just no one was showing up. Mm-hmm. We have an identity as a late night cocktail bar, and people don't associate that with going out early in the morning for brunch.
Question, if someone doesn't show up, do you have backup guys who you've either fired before or who you haven't hired?
You don't, yeah,
or
I mean,
do you just deal?
I take it back.
Yeah, it's a pretty
you're hired
good,
again.
Yeah. It's a pretty good rule of thumb that if you fire someone, you don't bring them back.
Right.
But no, it's usually it just falls on whoever is there. People just pick up slack. I mean, mm-hmm. it's different for every operation. Sometimes you do have guys that are kind of like your mercenaries that come in whenever needed. That's always good to have in your back pocket. But for me, I always prefer to just cross-train everybody. And
I see.
So they're able to do each position and each job.
How many strikes does someone get for not showing up?
Oh, I think that all depends on how good they are on making up a story as to why they didn't show up.
I see.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I think it's the same thing. It's, you know, people, we used to do dinner at Egg for years and it was fine, but it was never felt like it was quite enough to make it worth everything that went into it. I mean, the hours, the labor, keeping things open, the toll on the space, and people don't really want to eat breakfast where they eat dinner and vice versa. You know, hotels have this problem, right? And they're dealing with that in all sorts of ways. We're trying to have multiple identities for spaces because people don't want to eat in the same space twice in a day, or just associate that experience in a different sort of way. So we still do, you know, we do private events, we rent out the space, which is actually kind of perfect because we get the fun of cooking dinner every once in a while. We get to do some more creative stuff without the daily slog of doing breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you know, 7 days a week, which it would be exhausting.
Right.
And it's, you actually, as I recall, you do some
book
events. You do a book club, right? Once a month. What's it called?
Tables of Contents.
Okay.
Oh, very nice.
Thank you. we do. It's like a dinner series and a reading series. I was saving this for my for
well,
later.
Well, I was going to segue, so you can tell us about it, and
you're
then
going
we'll,
off script,
we'll segue
going
into
off
our
script.
Next topic. Go for it.
Yeah, it's called Tables of Contents, and it started about maybe 5 or 6 years ago. We partnered up with the Food Book Fair to do a closing dinner for their first fair, and I had this idea to do dinners based on novels for a while because I studied writing in college. So we did a dinner based off The Sun Also Rises for that first event, and we did 5 courses. Each one was inspired by a different scene. So we've done a number of those over the years, and now we have a monthly reading series where we have 3 authors come every month. They read from a recent book or something that they're working on, and we do a snack inspired by each of their readings, and everyone gets to taste it. So it's sort of like a really involved, edible reading, which is different than your normal bookstore
super
sort of
cool
affair.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's it's way more, it sounds just way more sensory involved.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it breaks down a lot of the walls of, like, I'm sitting and looking at an author reading at me. Like, everyone's sitting together at tables, and you're chatting with whoever's next to you. They might get up unbeknownst to you and be the next reader. You know, it's like,
do the three have to link in some way? Is there a theme for the night? Or
no, I mean, the theme is food, and we find it in everyone's books. Even the people who I reach out to and are like, I'd love to, but there's no food in my books. Like, trust me, there's food in your books. We'll figure
that's
it
so
out.
That's so fun. You get to be a curator of, like, whatever you're reading at that moment that resonates, that you think would people want to get together in a room.
It's like my backdoor, you know, as a former writer, like my backdoor into the world of writers that I wouldn't have been able to access through writing skill alone.
right. That's good. Well, let's talk cookbooks and bookshops.
So, yeah, exactly. The East Village. So we were just reading. There's a new one. The East Village has Bonnie Slotnick. Uptown has Kitchen Arts and Letters. Greenpoint has Arcstratus Books and Food, and we just read that there's a new one opening in Cobble Hill later this month on DeGraw Street. Bookseller cool. Elizabeth Young is opening Cooking Cocktails for both of you here and Culture. They're going to carry rare cookbooks, new books, and collectible items. Patrick and I were talking about this yesterday. Like, Barnes & Noble used to be the enemy of bookstores. Now it's one of the last remaining holdouts and a purveyor of many cookbooks. So we know everyone wants to write a book. I think Egg has a book, right?
We've got a book.
Okay. I don't know. Do you guys still buy physical cookbooks? Do you like to go to these stores? Obviously, Evan, we know your connection now.
Can I say I want to murder the cookbook industry? The last thing the world needs is another fucking cookbook. Do you know what a waste of paper it is? There's a gazillion cookbooks. They come up with 5,000 cookbooks, I think. I would like one encyclopedia on ingredients, you know, that just come in. And that's it. That just stop with the cookbooks. You could build a Mount Everest of cookbooks. It's too much. I don't care if people buy it or not. I'm just obviously playing devil's advocate.
I hope no future guest of ours who comes on to talk about a cookbook has heard this episode.
It better be original if it's a cookbook. Come on. Yeah. I don't know. That's just, I'm playing devil's advocate, but the world needs another cookbook.
What about the old trees? But so this new shop,
what about books? You don't want books anymore?
Oh, I like books. Another cookbook.
I don't think the cookbooks are destroying trees.
I do think there's like, you get a couple, you know, out of the hundreds or whatever cookbooks that come out every year,
you have to be discerning.
5 to 10 max are like great. Really good. So I totally agree. I think we don't need another Inspiralizer cookbook or another juice book or, you know, even lots of books about, you know, specific cultural food are repetitive. But, you know, sometimes like I felt like salt, fat, acid, heat was kind of a new thing and really useful for so many people. I've given it to tons of people as gifts. And it's like folks who aren't cooks who might be intimidated by the format of some cookbooks are like, oh, this is new. I get this. So once in a while, I think something.
What does a cookbook do? Like to break your mind? You're like, oh, that's a way to cook vegetables that I never thought of. Or he has a new perspective on combinations of flavorings that I never saw.
I think
saw.
Sometimes it's like maybe a culture you're not familiar with the food with that hasn't had a lot of attention before. Like I would say the most recent cookbook that I bought that I really enjoyed was the Asuka cookbook. It's just a different perspective on food. I'm more of a traditionalist, and so when I see someone like that doing things that are very out of the box, it's just intriguing to me. Mm-hmm.
Do you also buy a book maybe because of the chef who wrote it? Like, is it that you want a better sense or lens into their style if you've never staged with them, if you've never been in their kitchen? Does that translate?
Sometimes. I mean, for me, I like Evan, I love books, and I grew up reading, and I loved writing.
That's why we put you together, of course.
Sneaky.
Of course.
But for me, I just like, it's usually just a personal feel. I'll go to bookstores sometimes and if I see a cookbook I haven't seen before, I'll pick it up and browse through it. And if things in it are actually catching my eye, then I might purchase it. If not, then I'll just put it back. If you open it and it looks like a bunch of stuff you've seen before, I just put it back.
Do you cook off recipe books ever? Like at the restaurant when you're testing out new kitchens, you're like, I'm going to make the egg version of this or the employees only version.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great place to like, you know, you might not cook the exact same recipe, but
inspiration.
Browsing through and seeing something like, oh, that's, I want to do something like that. Or this is somehow fills out the beginnings of an idea I had about something else. It's just different than going online and searching for a specific recipe or whatever. It's like, there's a whole story being told there and, you know, there are recipes you find in cookbooks that you're not going to find online for whatever reason. And your path to discovering them is totally different. It just feels, I don't know.
I do love the story around a lot of the dishes in cookbooks. I think the best cookbooks give an intimate personal story.
Give us two cookbooks, guys. So, I mean, one, two cookbooks of your...
Or the one that's dirtiest on your shelf. Passion. I don't know. What's your favorite?
I can't remember the name of the book, but Sean Brock's book.
Heritage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I dive into that one pretty often just to look at stuff.
What does it offer you? Like a southern take on cuisine?
Yeah. I mean, I'm from Florida. So it's a book that's not your typical Martha Stewart view of southern food. Mm-hmm. I like to see that and just to see what he's done and his passion for food and his story behind why he likes using the ingredients that he likes to use.
He has a restaurant in Nashville, right?
And in
Charleston. Charleston, yeah. Do it.
Well, I mentioned salt, fat, acid, heat, which I think is awesome. I go back to the Bar Tartine cookbook a lot because they just have like really interesting preservation techniques. And my first kind of cookbook that I cooked from was in college. It's called Roast Chicken and Other Stories by Simon Hopkinson. Mm. And that I was captivated by the writing. You just want to read this as if it were a book because the stories behind all the recipes are great. And I think that's what was my entry into like, oh, now I'll try actually cooking what's in here. Yeah.
Well, I love books that talk about technique and all that because I think like with our meats, which are a little bit more expensive, I think people put so much effort into these like 2-day braises that it's not quick food, but it should be. Like our pork chop should be. So sometimes I think slow food is fast food. You can grill a pork chop in 5 minutes, and if that, you know, could still be heritage. But I think when people have that heritage chop, they're like, oh no, I need to find a cookbook for this. I'm going to do this whole far out thing. So it ceases to become part of the everyday, part of the quotidian culture, heritage breed. So sometimes some books are like that. But I, of course, like you, Emily, I'm sure, rely on Tyvon's French cookbook from the 13th century as my go-to.
Oh, but of course. Of course.
But it's really fun to read that book. I read it a little bit in French, a little translated. They didn't have time. A lot of people didn't have time. So he's like, cook this roast for as long as it would take to walk around a big field 7 or 8 times. That's like literally what they write.
I feel like Patrick's cooking style is more of that verbal cookbook where you've talked to chefs that you respect, friends over the years, whether it be like Alice Waters or Angelo Garo, someone who's going to say, this is, or Zach Allen has his method for, I don't know, I think how he likes to do a chop and the certain amount of searing time versus resting. And you, I mean, you're fortunate enough to work with chefs every day who you learn their techniques.
No, I like to say everything I cook is medieval. So if I'm ever blamed for churning out a shitty dish, I'm like, they had different palates back then.
You just aren't refined enough.
You don't know. You're so new age.
Yeah.
Also, discovering used cookbooks is the best. That's I was in Housing Works the other day and found this cookbook that I'm not going to be able to read because it's all in French, but it's called Champignon. And it's like, has these amazing pictures of foraged mushrooms that are better than like in the mushroom identification book I have at home. So like, okay, this is a great resource and it has recipes for what to do with them.
You just need a translator now.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I'll figure it out.
When I went into Kitchen Arts and Letters, I was writing my master's thesis for performance studies at NYU on medieval food sculptures and the politics of medieval food sculptures and how the nobility would use food sculptures as a means to put messages into the food to like either inspire people to go on a crusade or to not conquer them. I mean, Catherine de Medici stopped wars by throwing huge parties that were so much fun, no one wanted to conquer them. And I remember going into Nack Waxman being like, hi, you know, I'm some pimply faced grad student being like, hey, I'm looking for medieval food sculpture books. He's like, follow me. And, you know, shows me 30 books in that little place on Lexington Avenue, 92nd Street. And it is awesome. People should absolutely support those types of things. But they should think off the beaten path. I mean, they should look to old books, not to the newest.
Well, and I think that's what's special about shops like this and to see that another one is opening.
It's awesome.
Because otherwise, you know, you can go online for every, you know, current recipe. Mm-hmm. But to find things that are older, collect, I mean, they're copyrighted. A lot of things are not making it to the web unless someone's, you know, taking a picture of a book and uploading it on a blog somewhere. But I think that's really special. And the experience of being there and learning from people who have their own stories to tell.
So speaking of new and old, then we'll come back to the coffee one. What's the most original thing you've done in the kitchen food-wise? Like tombstone quality for like original or obit, you know?
Tombstone?
Like what would be written on your tombstone that you did the most?
I thought you were talking about the pizza. I was like, were they the first frozen pizza?
Get your mind out of the gutter. No, just kidding. No, but like what's the most original thing you've done?
I wouldn't call it a tombstone thing, but I think probably before I was at Employees Only, I was at a place with a guy who taught me a lot, Chef Carlos Barros, restaurant in Uptown called La Pulperia.
Pulperia, yeah.
And he has a kind of signature dish called Paku ribs, and it's this fish from the Amazon that's basically like a really large piranha, but it's vegetarian. And so he actually cooks it on a grill, and he cuts them into like they look like spare ribs. It's actually the ribs of the fish. This fish has just got ribs that are outrageously big for a fish, and he just does it like barbecue style. So it's fish, barbecue, ribs. And that was, I'd never even heard of that thing before. And I was like, where did you even find this?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, egg is pretty comfort food driven. We do some, you know, cool stuff with food waste and like using up byproducts. But I think the sort of the where I get my conceptual creative kicks is in like tables of contents and doing things that are sort of abstract interpretations of a scene in a book. For example, like we did a dinner with a writer named Heidi Julevitz and this artist collaborative called The Bellwether that was all around the theme of decay. So every course was some interpretation or example of decay, and there were interactive sort of elements throughout the night that Heidi came up with about time and memory and loss, and all that of that was tied into the food. So like those sorts of, how do you take, you know, art and food and bring them into conversation? That's the stuff that's, I think, sort of original for us and exciting, like creatively for me.
That's awesome. Well, for me, it would be having no talents really, other than being able to like throw grapes high in the air and catch them in my mouth. I came up with the words terroir, which is what chefs pass on. It's the terroir of the brain. Tête being French for head. So it's skills and knowledge passed from the brain and the hands from master to apprentice. I think there was no real word for your guys' genius. Everyone was talking about the food, but it was really you guys carrying on secrets of the trade. Carpenters have terroir. And then another word is, this was for Anne, but that little bit of cheese that's not the rind and not the cheese, it's that little beach of cheese. And in French, beach is plage. So plage du fromage.
Nice.
So those are my only two original things in food.
I can't follow that up.
No, all right. I'm out. So tell us about coffee.
All right. So I read this week that Italy's beloved mocha pots are in danger of going extinct. An icon of design, the mocha pot was patented by Alfonso Bialetti in 1933 and became synonymous with making coffee in places like Italy and Cuba. You know it. It's that silver coffee pot you put on the stove and, in my case, sometimes accidentally melt off the handle. Mm-hmm. It's happened more than once. Supposedly 70% of Italian families own a mocha pot, and yet we are hearing that the company has filed for bankruptcy. Analysts say ground coffee sales are declining and the pod capsule espresso sales are going up. What form of coffee do you guys drink? Do you have a mocha pot? Do you make your own espresso? Are you brand loyal?
This is that pot, right? It's the two upside down things that screw together. Well, the one and where, it has a little holder.
In my mind, why would you ever put the coffee grounds on the bottom and how is your coffee going to end up at the top?
Right.
Yeah, that one.
So what do you guys think?
I mean, I just go to local coffee shops. I'm pretty brand loyal, little variety. I've lived next to it the entire time I've lived in New York. So I've just never really gone elsewhere. But if I'm somewhere else, I always try to go somewhere local that's using like a local roaster or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, as far as the mocha pot goes, I feel like that like those things never break. Mm-hmm. Unless you melt the handle off.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so that's what I was thinking.
You could, like kill someone with one of those
things. Are they going out of business because it lasts forever? Like, it's the cast iron pan that, you know, Lodge sells you one when you're 20 and you have it until you die. You know, unless you've rusted it. And
70% of Italian families have them. They're probably all from, like, 1920.
Yeah.
So,
like, so that's my only theory is, like, is it too good of a product and you have one and you pass it down? You know, my mother-in-law is Cuban and she just likes to buy things for all of us. So we each have one of them, but I don't know. Like, are they just, they don't need to be replaced?
Does the capsule deserve to have kicked this out of the business? Does it make a comparable like coffee?
No. I don't like the capsule. Capsule's bullshit.
Yeah.
Can I say that on Heritage Radio?
Yeah. Absolutely. Not about the capsule. You can say bullshit.
Okay. Sorry. Heritage is sponsored by the capsule.
Yeah. How dare you.
We have a, I have an espresso machine at home only because Rachel, my fiance's mom, used to be a copywriter and she used to work for Ely. So she had like old, like a free espresso machine that she gave us a long time ago. And it makes pretty good coffee. So like that or French press at home. But
what coffee do you use? And are you loyal to like, are you using Ely coffee?
No. Usually I just buy coffee from Egg because it's much cheaper. So right now we're using, we have a blend with Brooklyn Roasting and then we're getting a blend from Devotion as well for our French press at the restaurant. So I use those. Sometimes I bring coffee back from Japan because they have really cool stuff that I've never seen here before. Mm-hmm. But just as often I'll go to a local coffee shop because especially if I have a day off, I don't often want to be in my house. I want to get out have a coffee, be somewhere, see people, you know.
I like cheap coffee, actually, just like deli coffee. The taste of it I like better. But I will say this is yet another example of Italy losing out on a business that it should dominate. I mean, when Starbucks opened in America, you were like, Italy, you're such a mess. Why don't you have anything here? Why don't you have a chain or nothing? I mean, Italy and Lavazza are well known, but not because they exist a shit ton, just because I think people see it at a few different high-end restaurants. But, you know, they should own the espresso business. They should own the Starbucks, you know, business. But somehow they're just so ideological or whatever, just bad at business that they lost out. And here's yet another espresso machine going out of business when it shouldn't.
It's true. I don't know. But I like, I guess it's bad to say, I like Pete's Coffee. They're out of Seattle also. And I don't put them on the same level as Starbucks just because they don't have shops everywhere, at least not on the East Coast. I just don't like any coffee that's super acidic. Like, I don't really like the pre-done cold brews either. Like, they're just, I don't know.
Did you ever see a Best in Show where the two people who had the worst, the gray dog, were like, we met at Starbucks that were kitty corner to each other. I was at one Starbucks and I looked across the street to the other Starbucks. Yeah, too many of them. Anyway, so take us to our last story, or should we go to the break already?
Yeah, let's go to a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more with Jackson Stamper and Evan Henksor. Is that how I say your name?
We'll fix it at the break.
All right. Stick around.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enameled cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Before we got our Le Creuset, the cookware we used most often was an antique Griswold cast iron pan. It didn't take long for me to realize how much I'd been missing enamel cast iron in my life. Le Creuset has the superior heat retention of cast iron, but paired with the unparalleled performance and ease of enamel. That means delicious food with easy cleanup. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's LECREUSET.com/HRN to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
All right. Oh, wow. Sorry, guys. So loud. We're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Sponsored by Le Creuset, the nicest pots in the world.
I guess I shouldn't have mentioned Lodge before. I'm so sorry, Le Creuset.
Yes,
buy absolutely. One Le Creuset, you have it forever. We have here with us Evan from Egg, Evan Hansor.
You just and, gave up. You just yeah, gave last up. Name.
And Jackson Stamper from Employees Only. We have some questions for the weekly grill. But first of all, it's November, holidays, do's, don'ts. Are you guys open? Are you closed? Christmas, New Year's? How's
We're
that
closed
work?
Thanksgiving Day, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and that's it.
Is that like for your own sanity, for your employees? Like,
yeah, mostly for our own sanity, for arbitrary acknowledgement of holidays that we choose to value.
Jackson?
We're open for Thanksgiving. We do a special menu, and then we're closed for Christmas Day, Super Bowl Sunday. And then the first Monday of December when we do our Prohibition Repeal Day party.
But then New Year's, you're certainly open.
Oh yeah, we're open every other day of the week, 7 days a week. But Thanksgiving's an odd one just because we used to be closed for Thanksgiving, and then years back, the old chef, Chef Julia Joksik, held a special dinner for everyone that worked there. And while they were there, the phones just kept ringing. And the owner decided, we should be open for Thanksgiving.
So she
ruined it for all the other employees.
10 to 12 to 15 heritage turkeys a year, every year. Employees only since 2004.
I thought Jackson was just eating them himself. I didn't know you were actually open.
He's a thin guy.
That's awesome.
If it was me, you could say that. But all right, Evan, how does Egg Tokyo compare to Egg New York? Give us the differences.
Well, the menu is almost the same. We don't bring. We don't have Nancy's ham over there, but we
Heritage Bacon.
Or Heritage Bacon, which we need to talk about. If you guys want to start working in Japan, mm-hmm. that would be great.
16 slabs a week. Yeah, is that a palate?
We need it. But the menu is egg, and they do a great job. You know, they serve grits. We get Anson Mills grits over there. We have a great egg farmer in Hiroshima.
How did you get the bacon? Just out of interest, you just visited some local meat distributors and said this one tastes similar?
Yeah, they brought samples in from different, you know, providers, and we're like, this is as close as I think we're going to get, and it's not the same. You know, but just like any restaurant, you know, we're a year and a half old. We're actually opening the second Tokyo location tomorrow. But we're making like improvements, I think, as we go. So hopefully by next year, the bacon will be a little bit better and maybe the greens will be a little different.
But everything's the same.
Pretty much. Over I mean, you walk in and it feels like egg. They even built like a faux skylight, so it feels like the back room in the egg space now. But it's really kind of surreal to go to Tokyo, get off the plane, go to an apartment, and then walk over to Egg and feel almost like we're back in Brooklyn. Although it's newer and cleaner because it's a newer and cleaner restaurant.
Is it more expensive?
It's also Japan. Yeah,
more expensive. Same price.
It's about the same price in like American dollars, but relative to food there, it is more expensive than you know an $8 bowl of ramen for lunch.
Sure. So now, Jackson, you're the chef of a cocktail-focused restaurant bar. Does that impact on your cooking and the menu?
It does in ways, but not in negative ways, I don't think. There's both more freedom and less freedom. I would say that I keep it more traditional. You can't really get as crazy as you could in a place that's more food-centric, food-focused. But at the same time, I'm able to use products and make things that maybe I wouldn't be able to make otherwise because the bar being so popular gives me a bit more cost room to work with.
Are there people who come in just to drink or do you get most people who are drinking
to eat? Have you been in our bar post 10 o'clock?
Not recently. I must have the early bird special.
It takes 15 minutes to walk from the door to the restaurant. To get down that bar takes 15 minutes.
It was like that on the way out the
other
day.
Yeah, we're about 80-20, so it's about 80% just drinking.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on that note, is there a specific... We had a question for both of you. We know salty foods get people to drink more. Is there a specific item on your menu that translates into drink sales?
I mean,
for the people in the dining room, you're trying to up their check average maybe?
The peanut from the kitchen, the salty food that gets people to drink.
We're pretty... well known for our tartare, which is a nice little
where they do
salty
it there
track.
For you, yeah.
Yeah, it's a salty snack, and then also we do a bacon wrapped lamb chop.
I love that lamb chop.
Yeah,
so that's those been on forever.
Those are the two that I think are snackable and also good to eat at the bar that will probably get people drinking a little.
Also, you can hold a little lamb chop when you're like three people deep at the bar.
Yeah, and then late night we do French fries. So,
oh really? People, not during the day? I mean, not during the early part of the
day? No, we switch menus at midnight.
What kind of fry is it?
It's just like a kind of thin. Thin cut fry. We do a Parmesan fry, and then we do a garlic fry and a rosemary fry.
So is the drinking at Egg Tiny? Is everybody just drinking coffee?
Yeah, people have mimosas and Bloody Marys, but you know, it's not like we don't sell a lot of wine. We don't sell that much beer. But people will come in. We get a decent amount of tourists. They'll come and have a beer with lunch during the week. But I think for breakfast, you know, the sausage is one of those saltier items that people tend to get as a side with grits and eggs that could make you want to order an extra mimosa and the country ham biscuit. Of course, the country ham is salty and smoky and everything, and it needs a washing down. So,
but it's a challenge, right? To make it financially without a large
amount of
alcohol.
Yeah, we don't have that cushion of a bunch of booze sales. Exactly.
So, but diners are hugely expensive. I mean, even shitty diners that I love.
It's true, you don't think about that.
They're very expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, a cheeseburger at Nectar Coffee Shop on the Upper East Side costs like $19.
Right.
And it's nothing
special. Like more
special.
Than... our burger, you know, cost at Egg. So yeah, it's definitely a different numbers game to play. Like keeping things look, you know, affordable because it's breakfast and we want it also to be affordable for people. but not having those booth sales to bump it up.
Mm-hmm. So we have two more questions. I'll ask Jackson's, you ask Evan's, last two. So Jackson, everything around you in the West Village is like from the 19th century. Like Dylan Thomas died at a bar there. You know, you have all this stuff going on. It's like the foundation of the Stonewall, right? Mm-hmm. It was a movement there, all this like history there. And then you guys were like new kids on the block. And now looking at gastronomy and food culture, you're dinosaurs now. I mean, you're one of the very first. So what's that like? I mean, you're kind of an institution in a museum-like neighborhood in New York.
Yeah, it can be pretty interesting. I think one of the things that I love about it, about the longevity that we've had there and the things that you get to see is pretty much, I would say, 10 times a year we'll have someone call and be like, hey, I met my fiance at your bar, we're getting married, can we come by, can we do pictures, can we have dinner? And that's just like a super cool thing to be a part of, and to see it happen so often because we've been open for so long is really cool. And then it's just being that name in the industry is really honoring. It's just it's nice.
You're viewed as a cocktail founder, right? I mean, you were one of the first times where the bartenders were like awesome, good-looking
guys.
They
wear chef jackets.
Chef jackets, and the menu was 30 pages long. I mean, you were a real pioneer, right, in the city?
As far as like the speakeasy cocktail scene goes, yeah, they were one of the early ones, along with people like Julie Reiner, and then places like PDT and Milk and Honey and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Yeah,
they old were, school.
So yeah. Quickly, so you're going from old school West Village to the glitz and bright lights of Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's right. I am. I'm moving to Las Vegas, not a place typically associated with age.
And what's the plan for there? Is it going to be a speakeasy?
My wife and I are opening a bar, so it's going to be kind of an adult dive bar in the front and then a very fancy upscale cocktail bar in the back. It's going to be called Mr. Wednesdays.
Awesome. On the Strip or off the Strip?
Off the Strip, Arts District.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. When will you be open? When can we visit?
Oh, that's... we're hoping for spring. Yeah, maybe late spring, April, May.
All right, off the Strip is great. Yeah, I think maybe 15, 20 years ago it was not. There were just a few kind of ethnic restaurants that were maybe fantastic, but now it's really, really cool. We're lucky enough.
Yeah,
to
no, off up. The Strip is tourists are going off the Strip. Locals are going off the Strip. People want more things that take them away from Las Vegas Boulevard. So I think that's the way to go. All right, Evan, I know you're very devoted to upstate New York. You work with Glenwood. You have a farm. Tell us a little bit about upstate New York.
Well, we started the farm at Egg about 10 years ago, and the goal was to sort of solidify that connection between the food buyers, us consumers in the city, and the people producing that food upstate, and not be so sort of distant from that transaction. So yeah, I mean, we're way, not way up, but we're up about 2.5 hours, almost 3 hours north of the city in Greene County. And then I have ended up doing a lot of work with Glenwood, which is an ag nonprofit and farm that operates mostly in the Hudson Valley area. Supporting local farms, land access, sharing knowledge, testing ideas on their property, working with industries like the cider industry to try to provide, you know, more feasible revenue streams for apple orchard, you know, farmers up there. So yeah, I mean, it's been amazing. I grew up in Connecticut, which is just across the border from the agricultural region of the Hudson Valley, you know, and up into the Catskills. So the landscape and the vibe and the people are all very familiar. So it feels like a return when I go there. And of course, it's so central to the way we order and cook food at Egg that it feels important to actually be physically involved in it as well.
Awesome.
Well, very cool.
We thank you both for coming on. Yes. We recommend that everyone visit Egg here in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Employees only in the West Village. And then... EO. And then come spring 2019 out to Vegas for Mr. Wednesdays.
Yes.
We'll have us out. Will you, can we send you samples like a prosciutto and salamis and stuff that
you
we sell?
You can send me anything you want.
Okay, good.
He
as
would
long
never
as there's
refuse.
Not an invoice.
Well, tickets are now on sale for the winner, Winter in the Garden, Heritage Radio Network's Holiday Party and Tasting. It's on Monday, December 3rd in the Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. 6 p.m. is the VIP reception. That's really where you want to be. And 7 p.m. is where everyone else comes. Celebrate another epic year in food radio and help Heritage Radio Network get off to a strong start in 2019. It's our 10th anniversary, so it's going to be really exciting. There's going to be a VIP hour, taste your way around the Palm House, wine, beer, sake, silent auction, raffle prizes, and musical stylings from host DJ Cherish the Love.
Tickets are available at heritageradionetwork.org/gala. Stick around for Tech Bites up next at 11.
Thanks, Noam, for engineering such a stellar show.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Top and the gals don't mind.